if I could hope for but one thing for you. So you be curious in all that you do. 'Cause love like a flower just wants to grow. Oh, and knowledge like your heart just wants to be known. If you like, please subscribe. This is Bitcoin Study Sessions.
Hey, welcome back. So Lucas and I today, we're going to finish off our discussion of Lynn Alden's Broken Money, why our financial system is failing us, and how we can make it better. This caps, 6 weeks or something of conversations on this, and it does tie everything together, this final portion. My book has the tatters of that shows that reading. It has discolorations. I don't know why it's a pink discoloration, some sort of nameless fluid, which will remain nameless. But it's showing the wear and tear. So we're going to move on from it after this, but I'm happy that we get to talk about it and summarize the whole work and its significance. So part six, the final capstone portion, is financial technology and human rights. There's going to be three chapters that comprise that. I'll summarize that, but before, so as we usually do, we're going to give a quick summary of the state of things up till now, the book till now, put everything in context, and then Lucas and I are going to discuss it in more granular detail. So a quick summary of the book up until chapter six, a very short arc of this book, just to give what we're going to talk about context. You can listen to any of our past conversations, of course, for more detail on this, but a quick arc of the book is the nature of money is not as any particular thing that we have used as money. It's not shells or gold or banknotes or even credit. But the nature of money is as the ledger itself, that thing that we used, whatever it is, to record stored up value and to note the transactions of that value that occur between us. Banks develop because the thing that we were using to kind of record the state of the ledger, gold, was kind of the culminating instance of this. That ended up being very slow and difficult to use in an increasingly kind of international economy. Difficult to move it around, difficult to authenticate for day-to-day transactions. So people preferred to have banks maintain a ledger for them. This distances the ledger from the underlying substance used to record the ledger. We then have an even bigger problem for gold. The age of telecommunications occurs. This is the final nail in the coffin, essentially, for gold as a monetary standard, because now transactions could be done at near the speed of light. The exchanges of information that we do to note that we're going to exchange something of value. But the actual exchange of value, the settlement of that transaction when it was gold, occurred at a very, very slow pace. So their transaction and settlement, there became a speed gap between those in the telecommunications age. People initially began to deal in abstractions still based in gold, like a claim for gold, a piece of paper that said, I'm worth X amount of gold and redeemable in gold. And then banks circulated these and recorded these on their ledger. But with time and the speed of telecommunications, gold eventually drops out of the picture entirely, and we enter into the fiat era, where money is backed by nothing and is based only on notations on a flexible ledger, ultimately controlled by a central bank. The flexible fiat ledger has many problems. The book discusses them in detail. For example, it leads to constant inflation of the currency as governments secretly tax people by printing more money and thereby draining value from savings without kind of angering people by explicitly taxing them. This also, the fiat monetary system leads to increasing speculation as people continually seek to leverage that empty credit in order to exchange it for scarce real world assets like real estate. In this story, all these problems develop. The entropy of the fiat ledger is described in detail by Alden, but technology doesn't stop. We have this kind of interregnum period of the fiat monetary system, but now we have new intervening technology. If speed gives us the fiat system that we now have, what are new technologies going to give us, specifically the internet and encryption? When you combine these, do we get some sort of new monetary order, some sort of new ledger? So Alden describes two primary contenders for internet native money. One is Bitcoin, a decentralized ledger hard capped at 21 million Bitcoin and secured by real world energy. And the other one is our CBDC, central bank digital currencies, which are centralized ledgers, which kind of continue the fiat abstraction and financialization of everything, but add the ability for additional control and surveillance by the government. That brings us up to the last part of this book, which again is financial technology and human rights. We're going to see the importance of those things and why Bitcoin emerges between CBDCs and Bitcoin, why Bitcoin is the one that is going to help us preserve human rights. So there's three chapters here. The first one talks about privacy. In the past, privacy was ensured because it was physically hard and costly to surveil people. You had to follow them around and stuff like that. And in the past, physical bearer assets were used as money, like gold, which, you know, that was the entirety. It was the value was in the object, and you gave that and you completed the transaction and settlement at the same time. Gold, shells, these types of things. They're private. When you give somebody that, they don't know. You don't have to tell somebody else why you gave a third party gold. Cash is also private in the same way. You can pass someone $50 without the government knowing about it. But now people mainly hold money in banks, and which people are encouraged to do so by inflation. If you don't have your money in a bank, if you just have cash under the mattress, it's continually losing its value. In addition, governments encourage this transfer of money into bank accounts. France banned cash transactions over 1,000 euros. Germany required background check for gold purchases over 2,000 euros. So governments are encouraging people to put money in bank accounts because bank accounts allow for government surveillance. In the past, we've talked about the Bank Secrecy Act. Transactions over $10,000 have to be reported to the government. There's various ways in which bank accounts just centralize our money. And of course, the banking system ultimately is under the surveillance of the government via the central bank of whatever nation maintains that central bank. But now technology, in addition, technology is enabling mass violation of privacy over time, the way, in addition to bank accounts, other technology has developed. So we can't expect laws to protect our privacy because it is the government that leads to the encroachment. And Alden kind of gives a timeline of justifications that the government has used to encroach on privacy via new technologies. In the 70s and 80s, we had the war on drugs. A new technology comes out, pagers, and there's a moral panic because drug dealers are using pagers. And so the government institute credit checks for people that want to buy pagers. In the 2000s, there's the war on terror. And of course, there are many different, we have the Patriot Act, many different infringements. Alden discusses Edward Snowden's leaked information from the NSA in 2013, revealing that the government had the ability to tap or obtain email, video, and voice chat, photos, social networking details, and that there were secret courts and unclear protections for American citizens in this process. And programs like this still exist, still a relic of the war on terror. Also, she notes there's client-side surveillance, things that were intended for military surveillance, military usage, but end up being turned on civilians. Things like Pegasus, a mobile phone spyware app created by an Israeli cyber intelligence firm that can covertly spy on a target's cell phone, including utilizing the microphone and camera. Purportedly, this is developed to monitor terrorists. Now it's frequently deployed against activists, human rights advocates, pro-democracy advocates, and authoritarian countries. In the 2020s, then, we now have, as an excuse for the government to encroach on privacy, kind of wars against trafficking and suspicions of foreign alignment. This person is a Russian asset, something like that. In the 2020s also, China has turned surveillance into an export. Domestically, we've talked about they require QR codes in certain places to move around the country. They have facial recognition that allows for monitoring of civilians. They have a social credit system and automatic bank freezes, things like kind of a minute control and surveillance made possible by technology. And China is now exporting this, Alden says, internationally. They're the world's largest exporter of surveillance tech. She notes that and this is, I think, very interesting. This is actually part of their Belt and Road Initiative. We talked about that in past chapters, the Belt and Road Initiative being China's attempt to kind of duplicate neo-colonialist monetary practices like the kind of Western bloc uses through the IMF and World Bank, predatory strings attached lending to developing countries to get them hooked and to extract value. China does that through the Belt and Road Initiative. And one of the things, one aspect of that is they subsidize and encourage the spread of surveillance tech to other countries. So in this way, the government is not something you can trust. Historically, it's encroached on privacy with various pretexts. Alden also notes you can't trust corporations, of course. We have this idea of surveillance capitalism. In the 2000s, 2010s, we enter what you could say is the age of surveillance capitalism. This is a term that was popularized by Shoshana Zuboff of the Harvard Business School. Under surveillance capitalism, services seem to be free that we're getting online, but that's actually because our user data is being harvested and monetized by, of course, Facebook, Twitter, we're all aware of this, to create targeted ads. There's extensive monitoring, even by our physical devices, a Siri, Alexa, and then now everybody has a Ring camera on their door. You know, everybody's taping everybody. Massive amounts of data being collected about ourselves, by ourselves, through corporations. There's been countless data breaches of both corporations and government. Alden goes historically through many of them. You know, it's the extent of data breaches is always something that it's very jaw-dropping to read about, from both whole-scale government breaches in Brazil to credit bureaus leaking everybody's information. It's pretty massive, the amount of data that has wound its way to the dark web, all of our data. And so overall, we see developing a surveillance and control mindset, the idea that privacy must be given up so that nothing bad will happen to us. The solution, in Alden's estimation, we need to release new unstoppable tech, which is kind of the theme underlying our whole book, that tech is unstoppable and that changes the material conditions, which then changes history. And then new laws will follow privacy technology. Don't lead with laws, lead with tech. Which brings us to chapter 29, asymmetric defense. These are the defenses that are arising to defend our privacy. So there are both centralizing and decentralizing tech. Centralizing, all the stuff we've talked about, this surveillance tech, government control of the financial system, monitoring bank accounts. There's also decentralizing tech. Historically, the printing press allows mass printing of the Bible, mass reproduction of pamphlets so people could talk about the Bible, give their own interpretations, and kind of almost, you know, wrest the word of God from the hands of those who would use it to control others and talk about what they think that the authoritative natural law indicated. Another decentralizing tech is encryption, enabling private communications, which enables private communications between individuals because, you know, encrypting them prevents them from being openly exposed on the internet. Encryption is hailed as a liberatory technology by the cypherpunks. This is a movement, you could say, that begins in 1993 with the publication of A Cypherpunk's Manifesto by Eric Hughes, who is a mathematician and cryptographer. So the cypherpunks were about actively building and preserving systems using encryption tech. And I'll read, Alden talks about the manifesto in detail. I'll read a couple of the quotes she has from the manifesto because, I mean, it's really beautiful, and it summarizes also what they're getting at. We, the cypherpunks, are dedicated to building anonymous systems. We are defending privacy with cryptography, with anonymous mail forwarding systems, with digital signatures, and with electronic money. They also write in the manifesto, cypherpunks write code. We know that someone has to write software to defend privacy, and since we can't get privacy unless we all do, we're going to write it. We publish our codes so that our fellow cypherpunks may practice and play with it. Our code is free for all to use worldwide. We don't much care if you don't approve of the software we write. We know that software can't be destroyed and that a widely dispersed system can't be shut down. Can't be shut down. History has vindicated this. One example is Phil Zimmerman creating PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, in 1991, making it open source. And so Lucas is going to summarize kind of the description of that legal saga and what that signifies.
Yeah, so Phil Zimmerman codes this piece of software that allows for encryption that can't be broken, so far as we know. He puts it out, and he finds himself facing the United States military. The United States attempted to classify his code under the Export Control Act, which is the law that we apply to make it illegal for me to build a nuclear bomb in my basement and then sell it to someone in Canada or Turkey or wherever, or for me to build an attack helicopter and send it to somebody. Like, it's meant to protect the advantage that the United States has on the military battlefield. And so Zimmerman gets brought up. They try to classify it as a munition. So they're trying to classify code, letters and numbers, as a munition, as a object of warfare. Takes us back to Jason Lowry's thesis, Soft War, where he definitively, I think he has done an incredible job of acquitting himself of having the opinion that Bitcoin is a form of munition. And in fact, it's the most powerful. Zimmerman, in facing this legal battle, decides to prove his point, how absurd this is, that code is being classified. And so he publishes it under an MIT open source license. So he basically writes a book on PGP and gives out the source code. It becomes popular at the time for people to, in the know, to wear t-shirts that have like the code on the t-shirt. And then it says like, this t-shirt is a weapon. This code is a weapon. So what happens then is that, though they don't necessarily give a reason, possibly because, and I think we'll get into this later because I want to hear the rest of your summary, possibly because the government would have had to reveal some things in order to make their case that they didn't want to reveal, or possibly because they just saw that it was a pretty worthless approach and they were attacking free speech, they decide to drop the case. So that case never was resolved. So there is a not necessarily a precedent for code in terms of being upheld as free speech, but a precedent in the more native sense of this was tried and it didn't work. They literally didn't even go through with the court case. So kind of a little bit of background on that.
Yeah. And then after that, cryptography goes on to play a very large role in making e-commerce secure. So we have that initial saga, and then it, you know, cryptography is now part of the internet. Governments have also are now seeking to regulate cryptocurrencies in the same way that maybe they initially sought to regulate something like PGP. Its justification often being that we need to do this for anti-money laundering purposes, that crypto is used by Russian oligarchs, by terrorists, by drug traffickers in order to launder their ill-gotten gains. But Alden poses, you know, we can argue that with the empirical nature of that claim, but I think Alden tackles this in a very interesting way. She poses three questions to regulators. And I think that the three questions are, first, to acknowledge the trade-off, second, to examine the motivations, and third, to be realistic. So first, acknowledge the trade-off. What should be given up to ensure that the small fraction of the population that engages in this illicit activity cannot do so? So first, acknowledge if you're going to, you know, you're going to be doing a trade-off, any anti-money laundering thing, you're going to be doing some sort of trade-off of other values like privacy. Second, examine the motivations. How honest are governments regarding their motivation for these trade-offs? And she gives example of Argentina, the currency rapidly debasing, and so people beginning to flee to a different ledger, the ledger of crypto. The government then adopts provisions against this to prevent this capital flight, but cites anti-money laundering as the reason, whereas Alden thinks that that's not the real reason. And then third, so acknowledge the trade-off, examine the motivations, and third, be realistic. Can the government even enforce it? She mentions, you know, Napster, centralized, you can shut that down. BitTorrent, decentralized, much more difficult to shut something like that down. Bitcoin, closer to BitTorrent. So can the government actually enforce their, you know, any purported regulation of cryptocurrency? They need to first ask themselves, is this actually something we can regulate? So legislation, she notes, that seeks to ban, for example, open source wallet anonymizing techniques is simply seeking to ban some iteration of some form of mathematics, which is very similar to the Phil Zimmerman situation. This brings us to the last chapter of the book, A World of Openness or a World of Control. The stage is set for us to enter one of those two worlds. Bitcoin's potential is to support an open world. The past chapters have mentioned how human rights advocates, activists have been funded by Bitcoin when authoritarian governments debank them. And now Alden gives an example that's more, perhaps morally complex, more close to home for people in Western democratic countries, the Canadian trucker protests in response to COVID mobility restrictions. The protesters needed money. You always need money to fund a protest. You're away from work. They were debanked, though. Their GoFundMes were shut down. And it turned out that Bitcoin was one of the only ways they were able to be funded. So without going into whether you agree or disagree with that cause, you should at least, Alden thinks, be pro ensuring the freedom of speech and due process, which is what Bitcoin enables. To quote Alden, custodial financial services allow governments to freeze accounts first and then sort out who is guilty or innocent later. Self-custodial financial services force governments to actually charge people with the crime before they can use pressure to freeze their accounts. So the government can't just shut down debate by freezing bank accounts. If Bitcoin is in the picture, they're actually going to have to allege that the people are doing something against the laws, find the laws, and charge them. Which in an emergent situation can be difficult. So what does it mean to support an open world in this way? And this, I think the Canadian trucker example really opens us up to this question, because some people, you know, would say, well, I didn't, you know, I thought it was good to restrict mobility a bit to prevent the spread of infectious disease. And we need to have that ability as a government. So Alden poses the question about maybe the implicit or native politics of Bitcoin. Quote, what exactly is the political nature of the network? Is it only for cypherpunks and libertarians? Alden thinks not. She thinks that what it is anti-authoritarian, and anti-authoritarianism is not just on the left or right. And she gives a good example of the, after the 2008 financial crisis and the resulting selective bailout of the people who caused the crisis, we had both the emergence of the Tea Party on the right and the Occupy Wall Street on the left. They're both emerging to protest the same point, the use of the flexible ledger to bail out those closest to power who are already rich and powerful. So to quote Alden, today, Bitcoin as a network collects members from both types of groups and partially organizes them in an emergent way by giving them something to use and build on so that they don't have to rely only on protesting. It offers them a way to potentially opt out of the existing financial system that they view as being heavily corrupted and to build a parallel peer-to-peer financial system instead. And Alden develops the point, you might say, the leftist take on Bitcoin. She doesn't do that for the right, and we can see maybe because, you know, there's already kind of a dominant libertarian picture of what Bitcoin could and does represent. She develops the leftist take on what Bitcoin could represent. And she says, a way to curtail corporate overreach and crony capitalism, in that Bitcoin provides a check on really all forms of consolidated power. It's designed to take back the public ledger from where it is currently controlled, you might say, from a leftist point of view, by corporations in the form of the revolving door between them and the government. And so Bitcoin is going to, in that way, hopefully combat crony capitalism. She also notes that the left kind of generally tends to oppose war, and they did oppose the Iraq war, which was financed through a opaque taxation, which is made possible by the fiat ledger. So it's not just white crypto bros or shadowy coders, she said. And she does give a list of human rights advocates who are currently working on Bitcoin in different capacities. And it's a great list to read through if you want to get if you want to learn about interesting new projects and perhaps people to follow on Twitter and to maybe broaden your view of Bitcoin if you do come at it with a default libertarian view. In any case, people of all political orientations are beginning to feel that the system as it is, the fiat ledger, and the current monetary system is not working for them. And Bitcoin is a technological reaction that will have freedom expanding consequences, whether you're right or left. Alden ends with the overarching question then that has defined her book: who controls the ledger? That's the nature of money for her ledger, as a ledger. And so who controls that ledger is a recurring question for her. In early history, nature controls the ledger because commodity monies like shells and then gold have a natural scarcity and natural physical characteristics, like their portability due to their physical nature. And so in that way, nature, roughly speaking, maintains the ledger. Technology, though, ends this control. There's new shell-making technologies that people can use to debase that currency. And then there is the technology of speed that allows for an abstraction overlay on gold. And so technology breaks the use of commodity money in its past form, which leads us to banking in the central banking area, which leads us to the fiat system, in which governments gain control of a flexible ledger and can devalue savings and channel value toward their purposes in an opaque way. And so now we're at the digital era, and we have new technology, again, the internet and encryption. And so who controls the ledger? There's two possible futures here. Neither one is set in stone. We're all going to have to collectively fight for what we believe is right. Either bottom-up, decentralized control of the ledger through something like Bitcoin, or top-down, so bottom-up, decentralized ledger, like something like a Bitcoin, or top-down, centralized ledger through CBDC, central bank digital currencies, controlled by governments and their central banks. So in this, in Alden's estimation, Bitcoin is not about eliminating the state, but about putting it on a level playing field and making it operate more transparently. Bitcoin represents the closing of the gap between transaction and settlement, which was initiated by that age of telecommunications, which effectively ended the gold standard. But now with Bitcoin, we can move away from fiat as a temporary solution to the speed gap, and also move away from the abstractions and the financialization that were enabled by the fiat era. Bitcoin then, in Alden's estimation, to end this summary, could herald an age of simplicity, transparency, and robustness. So that is a summary of Lynn Alden's Broken Money. We've finished it out there. There's a lot of really interesting points in this chapter. And in fact, we kind of, Lucas and I, talked about it last time we got into some of these points, because they were already beckoning towards these kind of ideological questions. Just to start with a question, what do you think about Alden really focusing on what I call the leftist take on Bitcoin, and emphasizing, and you know, and saying it's not about eliminating the state? I think some Bitcoiners are of more markedly anarchist or crypto-anarchists, anarcho-capitalists, call them what you will, where the kind of elimination of the state is the end goal. But for Alden, it's not about that. It's about, you know, making it more open and transparent, putting on an open playing field, ending corporate and crony capitalism, the things that corrupt the state. So what do you think about that leftist take on Bitcoin? What I call a leftist take on Bitcoin, I guess.
Yeah, I think, because you have to call it a leftist take on Bitcoin, I believe that drops some clues. And I think the biggest clue is that because we have to call it a leftist take on Bitcoin, it's somewhat of an overt reminder that the actual leftist take has been abandoned by the left, and that the principles that liberal left-leaning ideologies were built upon no longer seem to be the ones that they are espousing in recent years. And, you know, these were people who believed in free speech above all else, that they should not be told what they can do in terms of their bodies, what they can do in terms of their affiliations, you know, the right to protest, the right to really be a combative element to the state that is coercive in the means that it provides the constant tension that you need. Like you need to have tension, in order to make sure that, one side doesn't go too far. You need to have something pushing back, because the nature of the state is control. And I think we need to separate state and government, because you can have government without having a state. You look at, even down to the family level. You know, a mother and a father, certainly govern over their kids in a way that they call parenting. If you look at Native American tribes, they have a governing council, but they're not a state. And so what's the difference? I think the difference is that, the state is the control mechanism that enables government to get out of control. Without the control, and specifically the control over the money, then you can't really abuse people. And so we're talking about, let's go two paths. And one path would be the open source decentralized money that is Bitcoin. The other path would be the easily censored, heavily surveilled, government-controlled, state-controlled form of CBDC. And I want to go back to that state CBDC. We talked about this in an earlier podcast. There's an old country song called, I think it's called 16 Tons, and it's about a coal miner who is bemoaning his existence in that he has to work all day and have nothing to show for it because he works for a coal mine and the coal mine issues the money that he uses. And in everything that he buys, he has to buy from the coal town, which adjusts its prices in order to extract his money back out of him. And so it just creates a cycle. I load 16 tons, and what do I get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. And I think that provides this perfect microcosm of what we are sure to see and what we're already seeing in places that have instituted a central bank digital currency. You see that the issuer of the money has total and complete control over the citizens, and they have no choice but to remain in the system because the money that they have earned in exchange for their energy, what they have given their life for, is taken from them, so that they have no control over it and they cannot use it in order to escape, in order to better their life, in order to do anything. So I think it's the perfect example to demonstrate, you know, a central bank digital currency that's just the coal company issuing company scrip that they then devalue whenever they want to. And if it turns out that they hit a tough spot and everybody dulls their pickaxes until the point that they all have to go buy new pickaxes in the company store, there's the new pickaxe, but it's five times the price that it was before.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it just, it steals away the opportunity to do anything. I guess that's where I go first when I think about that, is a 1960s country song about a coal miner.
Yeah. Well, I think because that summons up the values that we associate with the left, which I think is what Alden is talking about here. So the values that we typically associate with the left, looking out for the common man, especially with respect to big corporations, very powerful financial interests, and that is, you know, maybe the spirit of Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Wall Street as well. And that iteration of the left, maybe the Noam Chomsky left, is something that it's much easier to sympathize with than, as you noted, like the modern left, postmodern left, you might say, is different than that, in that it's an infatuation with power and state control as such, and perceiving not that the leftist values are important and the means to arrive at those are kind of to be decided, but instead looking at the means and saying government control, the means to arrive at the things is the thing that is important. You know, if you're going to support the working man, it necessarily means a more powerful government to do so. That seems to be a sort of default, you know, leftist take from today, instead of saying, no, what's important is the small coal miner worker. Maybe some sort of government intervention is what helps them. You know, maybe a union strike, you know, against the corporation, maybe a protest, maybe something else. But it just seems that like there is, when I was reading this, it just seems like there are people, the modern statist calls themselves leftist, but they're not a leftist. And maybe Bitcoin can be one of the small ways in which we reassert that actual ideological leftism on the spectrum is about freedom and liberty, and not about any specific means to achieve that, such as using state control to do it. And that maybe Bitcoin can be that thing that the leftists can seize on, can see that the underlying values are more important than the specific historical vessel that we've used for the past, you know, since Roosevelt or whatever, which might be a kind of a leftist idea of using strong government power to intervene and help out. Which is actually a very authoritarian model, as we listened to that Curtis Yarvin interview, and you know, he kind of motivates a sympathy between kind of contemporary leftism and his particular view, which is very right wing and endorsing a monarchy, by saying, you know, Roosevelt was almost a monarchist, you could say, in the way that he operated. And I think that modern leftism can be very statist. And just to tie this back again, maybe Bitcoin can represent a liberation of leftism from statism, and a reassertion that's what is important is that coal miner who can now save in Bitcoin, who is not going to be, you know, kind of opaquely taxed by inflation to fund a war that they're then going to send the coal miner's kids to die on foreign soil to support some cause that's actually dictated by crony capitalist interests through corporations that are trying to sell defense technology or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're totally on with that analogy and hearkening back to, you know, what's really sympathetic about the left and what real and true empathy means.
Yeah. So I think it's really important right now that we pay very close attention to what things are and not what we call them, because there's this very strong anchoring bias to be held captive by whatever it is that we grew up with. So we want to call a cell phone a phone. We want to call an iPhone a phone, because it derived from a cell phone, but it's not, it's a supercomputer, right? We want to call Bitcoin money, but we're stuck with the idea that the dollar is money. We're moving into an era where these new things are being developed that are replacing the old things, and we're struggling to understand the new thing, the new technology, because we're so anchored in what the old technology has meant to us. And I think that also applies to definitions of a political party. You can call them the left, But I think this is actually probably why it's been more popular to refer to that type of ideology as woke, because it's not left. It's not liberal politics. If you look at what they stand for, you know, segregation of people based on, not necessarily segregation, but discrimination based on race, discrimination based on, sexual preference, discrimination based on, gender, identity, all of these things, they stand for that. They stand for controlling speech online. And even so far as to boldly and overtly say that it's not just things that we don't like that we don't want to see, and it's not just things that are untrue that we don't want to see, it's also things that are true that are inconvenient, and we don't want to see that either. And so there, if you look at it from that perspective, then it's very easy to see that this is not a liberal left type of politic. This is something new. That is also something very old, which is, as you correctly point out, it's just an authoritarian statist, regime mindset. And, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. I think, you know, I feel, and I know a lot of, very good left liberal thinkers. And I feel for them because their movement has been hijacked, and they were infiltrated. And much like the strangler vine from Jason Lowry's thesis, is that they were somewhat taken over and choked out, and now they're trying to get back out and be that tension on the system that's needed. So, it's really good that she takes this approach, because less than an appeal to the left, I feel like it's a subtle reminder of what are the left's core beliefs. And if you're reading this and you believe that you are a left-leaning person, do these core beliefs resonate with you? Because if they don't, then you have been captured by something, and it's a good time for reflection and thought in order to think about really where your beliefs lie and why you have those motivations you do.
Yeah. I mean, something like Bitcoin, it's an FAFO type thing. Fuck around and find out. It's like a natural law. If you have an ideology and that ideology is not true in some sense to the human condition, then it's not going to interact well with something that it has truth as its primary criterion. Yeah. I think that, you know, one of the entropies of the fiat monetary system is kind of a definitional entropy, in that, you know, the fiat relies itself on abstraction, and it enters us into an age of abstraction. We're no longer trading a real thing that is gold. We begin to trade claims for gold, and then the gold drops out entirely, and like all of value is now an abstraction that you can print. And if you can print value, it's like, you know, then power really is the primary condition of reality. Once you can print value, the postmodern idea that power underlies everything and not truth becomes, you know, palpable. And so people begin to like think that that is, you know, maybe the philosophy we should all follow. Power does seem to be what matters, because those in power print value for themselves and their friends. And I think you're right that this awoke ideology, call it what you will, some form of a left-oriented statism that has actually forgotten leftism's core values, has arisen. And I think we maybe attribute that to the entropy of the fiat ledger, its abuse, its corruption.
I think you also need to really come to grips with what printing value means, because this is the thing that is a direct exchange. It is a direct equivalent for a person's life, you know, for their productive capacity. This is the thing that we exchange for our application of focus and effort in life. And so printing money is stealing life. And the more life is stolen, there finally comes a breaking point, I think, where a revolution of sorts, when people call Bitcoin a revolution, I kind of get what that means, is that it very much is a silent revolution. But steal enough life, bleed someone enough, then they will find some way to fight back. I was pretty touched by the deftness with which Alden approaches this last bit. I'm very, very calculated, very thoughtful. Calculated, not a good word because people think that's a negative connotation, right. but calculated in the sense that, she acknowledges, I think, that the anarchist libertarian-esque bent is very well represented already in Bitcoin and does a good job in trying to bridge the gap. I think what we saw in this election was that money is not a political issue, because one side tried to make it a political issue and got destroyed by doing that. You have one side that says we need to stop spending all this money, we need to be more reasonable, and another side that just continues to spend that money. And where the people voted, I think, really reveals that it was in 1996 or whatever, James Carville got famous because he told Bill Clinton when they were trying to figure out strategy, I don't know, 95 or maybe earlier than that, what was the strategy to win the election? And Carville goes, it's the economy, stupid. That's it. You know, people care about having the right to do this and the right to do that, but they really care about being able to get up, put in a good day's work, have a fair wage paid to them that they are then able to spend before it devalues in a society that's not trying to extract from them all the time. And you mentioned that, we have entered this age of surveillance capitalism where the value is just being continually extracted by these free services and free products. And
yeah,
Elon Musk, I was reading another book about him, like one of the earlier ones, and there was a quote in there from, like, he was like 20, I think he was like 27 or something at the time when they're interviewing him. And she asked, why is it so important for him to do these things? Because at the time it just seemed utterly ludicrous, like utterly absurd. He gets a payout from his first business, and instead of sitting on his laurels and waiting for something to come, he knows exactly what he's going to do next. And then he gets the payout from that business. So he sells Zip2, makes PayPal, gets in with X.com and PayPal, sells that, and then funds everything. Like, he knew exactly what he was going to do. And he claims to have had this vision for his life since he was like 14. And there's a quote in that book. So she's asking him, why are you doing this? What is so important about this? And he says, nobody else is doing it. Like, I would go make, arcade games and video games, but I'm not really seeing how that benefits the world, and nobody else is innovating. And he said that, the greatest minds of the generation have been lost trying to get people to click on stuff online. All the greatest physicists that would have been turned into financiers, lawyers, and social media entrepreneurs. And so we've just seen this huge drop in innovation where you can't it's made it, the money has made it so impossible to do anything long-term, because you can't save money long-term, that everything has become short-term and extractive. I think it's, yeah, it really reveals the kind of the sad nature of what happens as a fiat money really starts to spiral and fail.
Yeah.
Is that people feel kind of hopeless at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like what you say about money not being a political question or issue, because I mean, just kind of someone hearing that would say that's ridiculous. It's the most political question there is. But Alden, when she's summarizing the Canadian trucker protests, says, quote, "My conclusion was that technologies that make it harder to freeze money are not avoiding legitimate laws, but rather are about ensuring that government themselves follow their laws." So again, like Bitcoin as an almost natural law constraint on government is something that is above government, in the same way that gold's characteristics of being portable and durable, divisible, those are things that governments don't control. And so it's not political that gold has certain characteristics. It's also not political that Bitcoin has certain characteristics. You know, it's adoption and whatnot. It's going to be mediated through politics and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it does present a constraint upon government rather than something that governments will ever be able to constrain. That's the Philip Zimmerman story. You can't hold back mathematics in the long run, something like that. So Bitcoin is a new technology in the same way that telecommunications was, and it's going, you know, strap in and see what the consequences are to a certain extent. I mean, we need to still facilitate its adoption and make it, you know, help to bring it about. We can't just say it's going to defeat CBDCs without more, but it's got, you know, it's an easy and good thing to defend because it does have this almost natural law force behind it, and it acts as a truth-based constraint rather than a power-based construct. And so it's long-term, I think that that's a good thing. Yeah.
I like that you're bringing us back into the math thing, because I wanted to have you lead us into a little discussion on Cody Wilson and ghost guns, and kind of draw some comparisons. And there's something that I wanted to say about Mark Andreessen as well, kind of with relation to that. So link us from Zimmerman to ghost guns, in a way, maybe, and then give people a little background on that.
Yeah. I mean, I wish we were talking about this right before the podcast, and you know, that's when the connection crystallized for me, because we were talking about it. I wish I would have went back and kind of boned up a bit on the whole drama or whatever, but basically what happened. So if you're not aware, Cody Wilson, was an advocate and entrepreneur for gun rights, essentially the Second Amendment. And what he did was, instead of just, he was in law school, but he began to take a more active material role. He drops out and he starts.
That's a great mind save from being a lawyer.
Yeah, no, definitely. From a imposer on others to a doer oneself, or something like that. And he starts a company, long story short, to 3D print firearms. And so the question in this, the government comes down on him like a bag of bricks or whatever, that all these lawsuits from the ATF and the federal government, they don't want people to be able to buy a 3D printer, go on the internet, download a file, and print all the pieces for a gun to assemble it in their own house. Even though people do have rights to assemble their own firearm, they didn't like that Cody made it so easy and breaks it down.
No. But they didn't like that they can't track them.
Yeah,
they didn't like that they don't have control over them. Because right now, every firearm I have has to be registered in my name, or else it's an illegal firearm.
There are separate, right?
Isn't that what they don't like about it?
Right. They don't like to be able to they want to be able to surveil and control firearm distribution. And Cody facilitated something that was against that. So there's all these lawsuits against him, and it's similar to the Zimmerman thing in that, I mean, Cody's making the point that, a couple of points. First, once these gun files are on the internet, they're available to anyone, and anyone can get a 3D printer. Cody Wilson is facilitating this maybe but it's already out there. Anybody can already do it. You can't stop this technology. Go ahead and try. But the second thing is sort of Zimmerman type argument. The Second Amendment now gets filtered through the First Amendment. And you know, what seemed to be a weapon is now information once it's on the internet, and you can then begin to make constitutional arguments that are stronger or different in force than under the Second Amendment. And those lawsuits, as I understand it, there's a really good documentary called Death Athletic by Jessica Solche. It's an excellent documentary. It walks through all of Cody Wilson's legal, kind of the legal drama that's going on, these different lawsuits. I don't know. There's been so many lawsuits against him. I don't know what palpable gains he has made, if there's precedent set. There's precedent set regarding information, and it's, you know, whether guns can be information and therefore protected by the First Amendment. That's unclear. But that's the connection there, is that that's a literal instance where an arm is now sublimated into information and possibly therefore subject to a different regulatory framework. And also the way that information, once decentralized and put out into the ether, is almost unstoppable.
Yeah. So that's a really good example. Cody Wilson and the ghost guns is a really good example of an attempted application of arms control against free speech, free speech in the way of code. And one of the things that you talked about in the summary was the, you know, the question of what is reasonable, in terms of like concessions made in order to be able to track transactions. You know, this is the debate that we need to have. But what I think is so very clear with an example like Cody Wilson and ghost guns, or with PGP, or with Bitcoin, or with, Tor, is that it's not a debate. This is Jason Lowry's famous quote: technology does not negotiate. There is no debate. You can outlaw me being able to use a mixer, which anonymizes my Bitcoin, so that you can't trace the transactions. You can outlaw that, but I can still use it. It's still there. It's still out on the internet. There's open source protocols for this. It's just code. And so what can you do instead? Well, you can encourage them to domicile in your jurisdiction so that you can then shut them down. And I think I kind of have like a little different view, I guess, on the, so Trump wants to make the United States the world capital of crypto. And I am actually really leaning more towards a very libertarian view of, I think I would like to see crypto developed in places that have no rule of law, as opposed to the strongest rule of law, because the good things always come up to the top. If something is not useful long-term for, parties involved, for the people that are using it and the people that are providing it, then it just doesn't live.
Sandbox, that's not an area that has no rule of law. That's an area where there's a sandbox constructed within a rule of law system. You always need the rule of law. You need property rights protected with guns. I mean, you need the rule of law in order to have any sort of system.
But what I'm saying is, we have seen very clearly that it doesn't matter what the law says. You can't rule against free speech and digital code. Like what I'm saying is that it's not a debate. It's not a negotiation. You can outlaw the code you can outlaw the app, but I can get a VPN and I can use the app.
You can get a VPN because you have a laptop in a house, which is secured by the rule of law system that you exist in.
Yeah, so that's like the threat. That's like, you can get a VPN because I allow you to have a house and I allow you to have a computer.
Right. I mean, which is different than like if you're in North Korea or Eritrea or some Venezuela. Like,
oh, those are very strong rule of law places.
I disagree. The rule, though, that's where the rule of law
is. They have very strong laws.
It's a definitional thing. I think the rule of law has broken down there. They don't have the rule of law. They have the rule of exception. They have what? Maybe they have a law on the book, but it's always the exception that matters. It's always the state, yeah. The state coming into your house and saying, oh, this law says this, but you can't cite it against us. We don't believe it has law-like applicability. Yeah.
That's no different than the U.S. Like, I can't remember who it was. Somebody
it's
did.
It's quite different.
Somebody did an analysis of all of the regulations. This is floating around. I don't verify it, but it was from a very well respected researcher. He says on average the average American commits 3 felonies a day.
Yeah, there's a book called 3 Felonies a Day, I believe.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's yeah. Like, I mean, the only thing that's different is that we don't yet have a whole lot of people having their doors kicked in by the government and coming into their house and taking their stuff. We're just on the lower end of the spectrum. I agree that we have much stronger rule of law.
Okay.
But we still have that occurrence all the time.
Definitely. We have things like that occur, but we do have much, much stronger rule of law. And I think probably the strongest rule of law, if not, one of the strongest, if not the strongest rule of law systems on the globe. And that's why we're entrusted with the financial order as it is. And I think that's why people buy into the U.S. as an idea. And I think it goes beyond our laws too. There's like norms and institutions that underlie the rule of law that make it possible. We have people who believe strongly in the First Amendment. In other countries where there's no rule of law, you maybe have a default presumption that speech should not be free. These are, cultural values and norms are, substantiate a rule of law system. I think a capital of crypto on the presumption that it's going to be the rule of law system at least is a good idea. And that I think the rule of law is important for, a technological center to thrive.
It's not binary. This is a sliding scale. The rule of law of the United States may be stronger than any other country in the world, but every country in the world has been trending more and more away from rule of law and more towards authoritarianism.
Yeah.
And so that it's just rule of law is not a yes or no thing. It's a it's a relevant sliding scale. And just because we are currently the cleanest dirty shirt, we're still a dirty shirt. And the thing is, we haven't been getting cleaner. We've been getting dirtier. The whole pile has been getting dirtier.
I was just thinking exception was saying that we should go to where there's no rule of law instead of where there's
rule of law. It's not we. So that again, that's another.
Or thing. As the crypto not developers we, like, or whatever.
The people who are going to do this are going to go where they can be in peace.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. Like they'll find a way to get there. They're going to, right now. They're going to Portugal. They're going to Argentina. They're going to the United Arab Emirates, and they're going to I don't know, Soviet bloc country, I think, but I can't remember. But I mean, there's no we. It's like we don't decide. We don't decide where this is done. The way that the law looks and the way that the people are treated, that decides. And
no, definitely.
And if you are somebody who is creating products that when you put them out into the world, they change the world, and they change the world in a way that is undeniably better for all the people in the world. If you're trying to negotiate with that person, you have no foot to stand on, because the thing that they put out into the world cannot be stopped by you. Like there is no, like what I'm saying is, I think it's laughable that governments think that they can negotiate with crypto.
But you just said that crypto, like a sandbox is a negotiation with crypto. If a country establishes a sandbox as a regulatory framework, that's an attempt to lure crypto to your country. So governments can do rule of law things, which is to create an open atmosphere that protects property rights and doesn't regulate crypto and prevent what they can do. I mean, that is
the
a thing
is
that a country
sandbox.
Can do.
the world is a sandbox. I mean, the United States is a sandbox. It was designed to be 50 experiments or however many states. Everybody's going to have their own experiment, and we're going to draw whatever works best from that. We'll apply it to the other ones. We'll adopt it as it worked. The world itself is a sandbox.
Yeah.
There are some that have this, there are some that have that. And if you're the guy who is going to create something that revolutionizes the world, and you have the choice, guy or girl, and you have the choice to go to this country where in this little certain area of the country, we're going to say that we're going to lessen the amount of restrictions that we have on you. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, these overt restrictions, oppressive restrictions are still going to apply. And in exchange for letting you work without being thrown in prison in this little area, we'll take a 30% cut. If that's the negotiation, then those people are going to go, well, actually, I can go to this place, and they don't care. They're just happy that I'm here because I'm contributing to their economy by the amount of value that I'm creating. And so it's a legitimate argument to be made right now because governments are currently so strong and have so much oppressive force at their availability that they do kind of have a way to turn off or they do have a way to encourage negotiation, but that power is weakening every single day. And the power of what they're trying to negotiate is getting stronger every single day. And it's just, I think it's a very short-term thought to go, oh, we're going to control this. We're going to have rules on this, because very clearly there will be jurisdictions that say we're not going to have rules on this because it is no different than sending a text.
Yeah.
And we don't have rules on sending a text.
So if a jurisdiction says we are not going to have rules on this, you don't trust that jurisdiction unless it already has a rule of law system where they're held to that promise, where you can then litigate if they go back on that. It's those authoritarian countries that say, oh, come here, we're going to have a sandbox, we're not going to have rules.
Yeah.
And then you go to Dubai or somewhere like that, and then they can pull the rug whenever they want. You need a default background set of norms. You need a strong constitution. You need a legal framework that protects the freedom of speech and equal human rights to a certain extent before you can rely on a promise that come here, there's not going to be laws. And that's what the United States offers. I mean, is a strong constitution backed up by, the blood of revolutionaries and the revolutionary sentiment that lives in our breasts. And that's something that you can't just recreate in another country by saying we're not going to, mess with your company. Oh, they're going to mess with your company when it suits them because they don't have a background set of rules and assumptions that prevents them from doing that. So that would be my point.
I think you can't
undersell the United States and its revolutionary fervor, I guess.
What that means for the about. Yeah. This is the network state, which is we'll put the Constitution out there. Anybody can adopt it and then run it.
Right now, there are
right it's like now, here's are the source countries. Code for yeah.
That doesn't work though. Right now, there are countries that printed the United States Constitution and tried to run them. It didn't work because didn't have
it doesn't work because you can't fix the thing. You have to build a new thing.
Yeah, and you have to actually you have to derive the values for yourself that underlie a set of words that you call the Constitution. The Constitution is just a nice sounding set of words. We can even make a better one, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, this beautiful flowery language that protects you in every way, cradle to grave. But it means nothing if people aren't willing to die for it and haven't had ancestors that died for it and don't live in a country where they're willing to go to the mat to protect something abstract like a freedom of speech. That's not a background human value we necessarily have by being human. It's something that grows in your breast because you're raised in a particular way in a particular country. So
that's a great argument for patriotism. And I do believe that too. I do believe and agree that patriotism is, you need to be proud and you need to be willing to sacrifice for the greater good. And it draws people together. Yeah.
And this does tie back to another part of this chapter that I thought was really interesting, where Alden talks about China exporting surveillance tech essentially through part of their Belt and Road initiative. One of the reasons she says that they're doing that is not just to like control another country because they've, you know, subsidized their purchase through some sort of predatory lending. That's one reason that they want to export surveillance tech and get these and then subsidize its purchase by some country that wants to be able to surveil its citizens. But they also want to foster the underlying norms and values that it's okay to surveil your citizens. If China subsidizes surveillance tech in many different countries, then those countries begin to normalize that it's okay and right to surveil your systems. They go to the UN, they vote in that way. So by spreading surveillance tech, you begin to change values when people then accommodate themselves to the way that the world is. So the question is then, can Bitcoin combat that and be an antivirus to that virus, or viral in a different way and change norms and ideas relating to privacy, surveillance, and control in other countries, serve as its own propaganda in a sense, in the same way that China is trying to change world norms by spreading the violence of surveillance tech?
Yeah, we're back to, so it's monetary colonialism. It's not like actual, we're going to land and we're going to take over and we're going to put our people there, but it is still colonialism. And colonialism is at its heart the exporting of the ideal, or whatever your ideology is, the underlying beliefs that you have. And so, influencing, reaching out and trying to expand your area of influence in the world, to expand the dominion over which you somewhat control entropy, I guess, might be a way to think about it. When I was in Africa and when I was in Morocco, I was blown away by how much surveillance technology I saw. And it was all Huawei brand. The cameras everywhere. Like I've been in bigger cities in the United States that I feel have a lot of security cameras. Not like this, and just very overt. And you see how people self-censor there. I mean, I remember when I came back, and I think you were one of the first people I talked to. I remember when I came back, I told people, cause I went from Morocco directly to Colombia, and those are two entirely different worlds. One is a police state and the other is a cartel state. And in Morocco, nobody ever smiles. Nobody looks people in the eyes. They don't trust each other. There's a very, very, very low level of social trust. And in Colombia, where it's leaning more towards anarchy, everything's done in cash. Everything is done kind of out in the open. Private transactions are very private. The people there smile, and there's this really vibrant motorcycle taxi system where for like one peso or whatever, I can't remember what it was. It was one coin. For one coin, you just get on the back, they hand you a helmet, and away you go. And it's a very... I know this sounds weird, but it was a way safer environment. At least it felt safer. I don't know. Exporting that type of surveillance and trying to normalize it, having experienced that, that's the only place I've ever been in Morocco. That's the only place I've ever been where I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel safe. I didn't really want to be there because it felt like, you were always being watched and someone was always trying to catch you doing something. And this brings me, so the summary talks about how we moved through the war on terror, or sorry, the war on drugs to the war on terror, and then to the war on trafficking. And I was thinking about that, and I think it's more, we declared a war on drugs because they were opening people's minds and there was rebellion. And then we took over the trade of drugs and used that to finance our own operations. And by doing so, we enriched ideologies that then we decided we needed to put down because they were becoming a threat. So the war on drugs creates the war on terror. And then I would say after the war on terror, we actually, because we then had a war on terror where for 20 years, you grew up, you either grew up terrified of the Russians or you grew up terrified of people in the Middle East. And that war on terror funded by the war on drugs creates a war on hate, where now we have really created these people in our minds that we hate just because of the way they look, because we have been told that they're terrorists, who were emboldened and enriched to be, even be here, because of the war on drugs. And then that war on hate, I think the war on hate, what is hate? Hate is viewing people as less. And if you view people as less, you can treat them like commodities. And treating people like commodities is trafficking. And now we have a war on hate that has created a war on trafficking. And I wrote all those things down and then I crossed off war on and I just put, here's the mechanisms for control that have been used by the state: drugs, terror, hate, and trafficking. And the next logical is basically thought. And so that's really what I think you see in these countries that have gone in deep with the Belt and Road Initiative, is that the war on thought is very obviously being fought and lost by the people because of the manner in which they interact with each other and self-censor, and continuously accept more and more punishment in terms of losing liberty, in exchange just to not be crushed under the thumb of the state. So
So Alden had three questions for regulators. If you're thinking about regulating something, we already hit the last one. Be realistic. Can the government enforce it? We talked about that at length.
Yeah.
And I think you just got to the second one. Examine the motivations. How honest are governments regarding their motivations for, actually regulating the thing that they say they're purportedly regulating? Like, again, the Argentinian currency example. We say we want to go after anti-money laundering, but actually the motivation is to cut off capital flight from a burning fiat ledger. And so, right. And I mean,
I bought a tour bus and I had to pay cash for it. I had to go to the bank 3 days in a row to draw out cash so that I wouldn't be reported under. And it's not, you know, I could have drawn it all out. I think maybe they would have given it to me, but I self-censored. Like, there was something in my mind that said, oh, if it's over $10,000, then I'm going to get reported and I'm going to have a file or whatever. And it made me change my action just because of those kinds of capital controls. Yeah.
No, and they are intended to change actions. Like, yeah, that is for sure. Like, the explicit ones mentioned in France and Germany, where they're, you know, 1,000 and 2,000 euros, not a huge sum of money, but those are to prevent, I think it was in Germany, to prevent capital flight to gold. And then in France, just to prevent people from accumulating cash because, of course, they want money in bank accounts so they can surveil and control it.
It's like a used motorcycle. Like, you can't pay cash for a nice bicycle.
Yeah, right.
You know, if the French ride a lot of bikes, that's like a nice bicycle. You can't go pay somebody cash for a bicycle.
Now you begin to cut into the informal economy that way, potentially. I mean, I wonder what the effect has been on, like, resale, you know, private resale, things like that, because now you have to have, like, a credit card machine so people can use credit.
They would have gone up, right? They'd probably have to go – wouldn't they go up in price?
Yeah, right. So if it begins to cut off that market, it begins to be – right, it drives up the price for the people that can stay in it to negotiate that way. If it's really important to you to get, you know, get it on the resale market – yeah, no, there's all sorts of secondhand consequences when the government begins to regulate and you know, their motivations, and it ties back into, you know, us pontificating that maybe modern leftism as statism has different motivations than it proclaims or says that it has. So,
do you remember the story? Wasn't there a story about like a kid that they decided I don't know what country, but they kicked in the door and they found that he had cash, and they decided to hang him.
Wow. This was
fairly recently. I can't remember what, but
When I was practicing criminal law, Alden mentions here civil asset forfeiture, you know, in the United States, that's one way in which surveillance implicitly occurs. When I was practicing criminal law, there was an individual who was traveling from Missouri to Colorado with a large sum of cash in his car. He gets pulled over. And so Colorado at the time has weed that's legal. Missouri does not. Traveling with that large sum of cash in his car to Colorado was enough for the police to confiscate, to steal his money and take it in order to get that money back. So he told the police, no, this is for a vacation I'm taking to Colorado. We plan to spend it there. We're going to ski resort. It's going to be expensive. They took the money. In order to get that back, it was a complex federal civil lawsuit that had to proceed through district court. And that's an expensive thing that, you know, most people wouldn't do, because you're essentially, you know, paying the money that you're going to get back to the attorney to do that thing for you. And so that in itself is a way to discourage people from having too much cash, because there's a presumption that it's illicit or illegal, the mere fact that you have cash. So we might not hang someone in the United States, but we begin to implicitly categorize them as a criminal and impose civil criminal consequences on them for having cash.
I read a book about that, and it's the amount of abuse of the civil asset forfeiture power is shocking, especially in Texas. There were stories about they stop a family that has like $4,000 in cash, and I can't remember what the deal was. I don't think they had anything. It wasn't a big deal. But anyway, so they say, well, we either take your money or you have to spend the night in jail. You know, that's fine. You can spend a night in jail. And they're like, what happens to our kids? They're like, oh, we put your kids in the system. And so then, you know, they don't have any recourse. It is a very calculated way to extract value from people by making it prohibitively costly for them to get it back. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because if there are people listening to this that aren't aware of what the civil asset forfeiture power is and how it's being abused, I encourage you to look into it. Just Google civil asset forfeiture. And there's one example of like they get a warrant to go through some lock boxes at a safe deposit facility, and instead they just go through all of them. And so they just take everything. And then if you want it, you have to come prove that it's yours and prove that you have it legitimately, when they had a warrant for like one box or something like that. So, like there's a lot of abuses of power being
and one
used
does not have
already
to be,
in the United States.
And one does not have to be, to tie back to this left-right dichotomy, one does not have to be libertarian to see this. Because in addition to this, in Ferguson, there were these – Ferguson, Missouri, right? This is is a suburb of St. Louis, right? Or not a suburb, it's a part of St. Louis. That's
And yeah, so, I drove
yeah, Uber. So it's a municipality there, yeah. Right? And so there were race riots there. Was somebody shot there? There's been so many of these racial things. What was?
Yeah. It started. It started with a police shooting. The riots.
But after they did a post-mortem on it to figure out why were there so many racial tensions here? What's the problem with Ferguson? And there's a report you can read on this. And they had there was this really predatory municipal fining of people for small traffic infractions, and they were doing that
for the city was doing dirty windows or bald tires or not being able to see your license plate. And by the way, this is very real, still there. When I was there and I was driving Uber, I would pick up people and they would tell me this specific area, this one specific street, really. It's like, this is where they take you. This is where they pull you over. And they were just they talked about it so matter of factly. It's like, you're white, you're fine. You're going to be okay. But anybody else, they'll get you for stopping too fast, basically, or anything. Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off, but that's still a very real thing.
Just another
3 months ago.
No, another way that the government is harvesting people for cash, opaquely taxing people through municipal fines instead of outright doing it. And so, what a great system we have.
Yeah, it's I think when you realize that you have the power to extract, again, this just is the same with the government realizing that, if we can print some money, we can print all the money. you just have to, again, throwing it back to Elon, but I like to give him credit because he says these things that really stick in my mind. But you have to think to the limit. You have to think, okay, if we're going to do this thing, how far can it be taken? Because how far it can be taken is how far it will be taken by somebody. Somebody will get there. Somebody will do it. They will plant a flag. They will move. They will shift the Overton window. We will continuously move closer and closer into this direction until a limit is reached. And what does that limit look like?
And the limit does it look like.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the limit looks like that show Mr. Robot, which I don't think you've seen.
I have not. No.
The guy, I forget his name, but the dude who played Freddie Mercury in the Queen movie, incredible series. I encourage everybody to watch, which is basically the rise of the central bank digital currency and the corporation and the state applying all of these overt extreme surveillance powers on the citizens. So, it's a very dark dystopian view, but it also is a very, very real view in terms of what we're seeing across the world right now.
Yeah, no, I was just interrupting to throw some shade to see if what it looked like for a person to think of the max was to promote Dogecoin.
Not good, right? seriously, not good.
Even as a joke, even as a mimetic kind of whatever is the funniest outcome will be the outcome that actually happens. I mean, that's trying to meme into reality hilarity as a future, and I don't think that's a good idea.
This is actually another quote from Musk when he was working on PayPal was, he defines money the exact same that Alden does. Money is, it's just a ledger. It's just an entry in a database. Promoting Dogecoin is
wild. Have a talk with your boy there, man. Have a talk with your boy. He's
wild. I don't understand it. Now, let's also acknowledge that his company is the third largest owner of Bitcoin.
Tesla's got a stack. Yeah, Tesla's got a stack.
Yeah, this again, think about what actually matters. Where is your skin in the game? So I personally think that he knows exactly what it is and that in order to maintain relationships with a very litigious government that had been increasingly targeting him, I think that he really toned down any sort of slaughtering of golden cows or golden geese for quite a long time.
Yeah. I think he runs public corporations that depend on public largesse. And so Bitcoin is vaguely threatening to him with what he needs to get accomplished. His only goal is to get to Mars, and he's been working with the government as it is. And I think you stack Bitcoin because he's smart enough to do so. But I mean, I think he's, like most CEOs probably are, he has a point that goes beyond what Bitcoin's liberatory potential is. And so he wants to get that done. And if Bitcoin vaguely threatens that in some way, then maybe it's not your biggest priority. I'm not saying against it. I don't think, you know.
Maybe take another view of it, which is to say that I think, so he had the very personal experience, right, of having one of his children be chemically castrated under the trans encouragement laws in California, and has really struggled with that. He sold all of his houses, he sold everything, and just sleeps on people's couches now, right? Yeah. And I think he just identified that as a bigger problem, and I can't disagree, because the fundamental aim of that ideology was to outlaw free speech. It was to force people to it was to promote forced speech and take one step closer to legislating thought. So I think that if you have Bitcoin, but you don't have the antidote to that, then I don't think you're better off. But I think that if you have the antidote to the woke mind virus, then I do believe that Bitcoin naturally, kind of like the way you were talking about with the values that arise, I think that Bitcoin naturally finds its place in that system. So maybe it's more of just I think it's a close personal thing, where it's like, I have this trans,
child. I have no insight into his mental state. I wouldn't psychologize him farther. So I just think it's,
that's a good point.
He's an interesting person. Yeah. So that's part six, financial technology and human rights. I mean, that concludes the book for us. And like I said at the beginning, man, my book it's seen some damage here, and it's so much fun to so thoroughly and rigorously get into a person's head, to read their thoughts in this way, to reconstruct it for yourself, explain it to yourself, take copious notes. It's like a different reading experience. And I just wonder is there something overall that you wanted to take away from Broken Money? I mean, obviously we've had hours of conversation on this, but just given that we've concluded this book, just any concluding thoughts on the book itself?
The thing that I wanted to talk about that I think is just a very real example of technology matters more than ideology. Technology matters more than willpower. Technology changes things. The very first use of Bitcoin, she talks about it here in the final, the very first real use of Bitcoin was to help fund WikiLeaks after they were cut off by the United States for revealing abuses of the government. So I think that right there, that first use of Bitcoin, puts everything into an encapsulation for us. This is a technology that can't be stopped, that is viewed as a killer by the thing that it is trying to kill, which it's not trying to kill government, it's trying to kill abuse. And we're trying to move past and move forward to a system where we can no longer be unilaterally abused and have things taken from us that are ours, our lives, our energy, our contributions to society. They can't just be taken from us. And people rose up in the 60s because of this, but the technology wasn't there. And I would say the motivation was probably way stronger then. You know, people had a lot more fight in them. And certainly, you know, there were riots and there were massive gatherings and there were protests everywhere and people just actively dropping out. You know, the tune in. What is it? Tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's kind of today's silent quitting, or, you know, people have just like removed themselves from the system because the system, not only does it no longer serve them, it never served them. It just finally revealed the extent to which it would take the abuse. And people have done what people always do, which is find a way and rise up as one for the betterment of each other. You know, at the end of the day, we are all humans and we all feel a certain kinship. I think this is why it's very important for people to travel, not because of you want to go see the world, but what you want to do is you want to go to another part of the world and experience humanity and share the existence of life with someone else that you may currently think of in some sort of partitioned, separated, discriminated way in your mind. So yeah, I think that's the last thing that I have to say. I am really glad that you chose this book, because the second time through reading it, it really came to life, and having the discussions about it made me realize what you had said when you originally promoted the idea was that this was just the best top to bottom, back to, you know, front to back, not editorialized version of money and Bitcoin. And it's not commentary on society. This is what happens as a result of this. This is cause and effect being laid out to us in a very systematic way by a systems engineer. So I commend you for the book choice. I really took a lot out of it. Like I said, especially the second time around, it got to be so much more of a deep read for me. And I enjoyed it.
Now, one of the things I took away from it, and this maybe is a qualification on what you said. This is a book about technology. It's a book about the way that technology has disrupted our financial system, our monetary systems in the past, and given that we have new technologies, how it could disrupt going forward in the future, especially given the flaws that our current system has. The one thing that I really, especially during a conversation today, was reflecting on is technology will inevitably change things, but the direction in which it will change things is not necessarily set. So we have a world of openness, or what, a world of control posited as two potential futures, CBDCs and Bitcoin. You know, one is the better money, more sound money. One has a lot of state interest behind it, and the state being so intertwined with powerful elite financial classes also has a lot of support from them, CBDCs. So on a long enough time frame, maybe good prevails, but humans don't live necessarily on the longest time frame, because we need to prevent ourselves from, you know, mutual destruction in nuclear war. War is, of course, on Alden's thesis, made more likely under a fiat monetary system. It accelerates us towards wars and finances those wars. So, you know, maybe Bitcoin, you know, slays CBDCs on a long enough time frame by itself, but we don't necessarily have a long enough time frame. We need to do it ASAP. And so we need to do everything we can to, as Trump's new executive order, ban CBDC technology. But we also have CBDC type technologies like XRP being advocated for at the highest levels. These are debates we need to have, and we need to ensure that the centralized outcome is not the winning outcome. And it does, you know, we have to fight it ourselves. It's not going to fight itself. You know, you can take your Bitcoin stack and go out into the mountains or whatever and do that thing where you disappear. Or you can engage with these debates, read these books, talk to your friends and family, vote conscientiously, and work within the systems we have to build the systems we want to have. And so this is a very realist book. It's, I don't think, ideologically slanted, but it does present to you, all of us, a choice. You know, do you want are you willing to work to get the future that you want, even though you think that a technology is inevitable, and even though it may be in a long enough time frame? What are you going to do today? Here's all the information about why things suck and why they could unsuck themselves if we're willing to do something about it. So yeah, I thought it was an awesome book. And I agree with the sentiments you expressed, that, because I guess you relayed that they came from me, is that I do think it's one of the best, like, top to bottom introductions to Bitcoin, to a Bitcoin. Like, if a person is intellectually capable of kind of reading through a 400, 500 page book, and they're willing to do that, this is what you hand them, I think. If they're maybe vaguely of the left or moderate, you know, this has a really good take that's not going to alienate them with too aggressive Austrian economic scheme, a too aggressive, freedom maximalist or anarchist schema for looking at things. It's really going to give them a sober recounting of what money is, kind of historically, anthropologically, what our monetary system is and where it came from, why it has certain flaws, both as perceived from the left and the right, and again, from the left and the right, why we should settle on Bitcoin as a solution. So I'm really happy we read this, for sure.
Yep. Broken Money. Go get it. It is fantastic. Yeah. Great deal. All right. Well, I guess we will get together again soon and talk about something new.
Right on. Thanks, man.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like, please subscribe. Every little bit gets me one tiny step closer to my ultimate goal of living in a cave. You never have to buy windows or shingles, and there's no lawn to mow. Look it up. Dream big, kids.